This is Scott Becker with the Becker's Healthcare Podcast. Thrilled today to be joined by Timothy Pearson. Tim is the CEO of the Integris Health System. Integris is the leading health system and one of the great health systems in Oklahoma. Thrilled to have you on today, Tim. We'll talk to you about leadership, priorities, what you're seeing in COVID, and more. Can you take a moment and introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I've been at Integris for the last 2 years. I came here by way of Intermountain Healthcare, was there for 18 years, and prior to that I was worked for United Health and been at Samaritan Health System, which is formerly or now Banner Health System, and just had an opportunity to be both on the delivery side and the health plan side, and really loved Oklahoma and Integris. So proud of the work that we're doing here and this organization. It's a terrific place to work, and so that's a little bit about me.
Well, thank you. And talk for a second. We're talking about Integris mostly, but Intermountain. Intermountain has been sort of a breeding ground for great leaders throughout the country. How and why has that happened and become such a clear pattern? It's almost like a great coach that develops a ton of assistants that then become NFL coaches. Intermountain has done the same thing, great leadership there, and they've sort of developed a ton of different people that lead systems throughout the country. How has that happened?
I think Intermountain Healthcare is a terrific organization. It's got strong leaders. It's been focused on doing the right thing for a lot of years, and it really has been in a privileged position from a market perspective by, you know, through making a lot of really good decisions. And as a result, I think they've been able to attract and retain really good talent over the years, and that talent then has gone out and had the opportunity to go do other things across the country. So it's really is a terrific organization with a great focus on delivering value and best care. And it's fun to be able to take the things that I've learned and be applying those in Oklahoma.
And talk to us about the Integris system and a couple of your greatest points of pride in the Integris system. Tell us a little bit about Integris.
Yeah, so Integris is the largest health system in the state. It's a $2.1 billion system, 20 hospitals. We have 600 employee providers, 1,400 physician clinically integrated network. We're largely the largest player in Oklahoma City. We do have outposts throughout rural parts of Oklahoma, but we really lead Oklahoma City. We're not up in Tulsa. We're around Tulsa in some rural areas. And it brings a great culture of the desire to do medical first. So we do transplants. We're the first transplant program in Oklahoma. We are the burn center. And we just offer a diverse set of places to go receive care, whether that's through a primary care clinic or home health needs or whatever else our community needs. And we've become the most trusted partner for health in Oklahoma. So
you've done a great job of it. Talk for a moment about the transition to leadership. There's been all these books written about, you know, you come into leadership of a new job, a new system, a new CEO role. Some of your advice around that, different schools of thought in that. Can you talk about that? Because you spent 18 years in one system. Now for 2 years, you've been the leader here. Any thoughts on how you approach coming into leadership?
Yeah, so I mean, I think, first of all, in each, you know, while I was at Intermountain, I had progressive leadership responsibilities and left there as the CEO of one of the regions of Intermountain and also the Vice President of Continuous Improvement. And so in each one of those roles, you learn different things, right, as you grow in your career. And So it's taking all of those bits and pieces of things that you learn along the way and apply it in each of the new settings. And in the case of being the system CEO, it's obviously different than being a regional CEO. But much of what I learned in that regional CEO role was very transferable over here. There's others that weren't transferable. It was just learning by doing. But I found I was talking to Dave Entwistle, who's the CEO of Stanford, as a friend, and several other CEOs when I was coming into this role. And I said, hey, what do you recommend? And it was interesting, pretty across the board, most leaders who were becoming their first-time CEO, they said, you got to read Michael Watkins' The First 90 Days book. And it's been out for, I don't know, 10 or 12 years or something. But that was really helpful, actually, just to – and I don't think you necessarily have to do it for, you know, look through that for first-time system CEO role. I think you can use that book for anything. But it was very helpful in me just thinking about how to get my head around it, the responsibility and what I need to do to land softly but also move quickly. And I think that was very helpful.
And that's really sort of the point. How do you come in without trying to make your imprint on it, trying to observe for a while, but at the same time, you know, be a participant? I mean, how do you sort of mix those qualities? Is it a lot of meetings with the people that will be your direct reports and leaders? Is it trying to fill out your leadership team? What are some of the things you do as a starting leader? I mean, some leaders have famously gotten in trouble when they come on too strong too quickly.
Yeah.
But at the same time,
I tell you, it's tempting, right? Because you get in and you want to start diving in, but I really tried to pace myself and was pretty true to that, except one exception, which I'll tell you in a moment. But I just said, 100 days, I got to get smart. I need to be on a listening tour. I'm going to meet with everybody that I possibly can. So, you know, I met with all the executives, tried to meet with frontline caregivers, tried to meet with physicians, tried to meet with board members, and really just did a lot of listening. And what I was trying to hear was, what are the strategies of the organization? Who are the people? And what were the sacred cows that I need to be thinking about? And really assessing the talent that I had in the organization and, the strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats in the organization. And so, again, for the most part, I stayed pretty true to that. The one exception was when I was at Intermountain as the vice president of continuous improvement, I had developed what's now called the Intermountain Operating Model. And in that, we created a daily tiered escalation huddle where we could see and understand safety issues in real time every single day, all the way to the CEO. And in fact, I think even Mark Harrison's done a piece in the Harvard Business Review on that process that I set up. But I just couldn't live without it. I got after a month, and I said, I can't see what's happening from a safety perspective. So probably about 45 days in, I said, we're doing this, and we set up these daily tiered escalation huddles. And, you know, I got some eye rolls and whatever, but pretty quickly, within 2 weeks, everybody said, this is awesome, this is so helpful, and we were able to get some pretty good wins from a safety perspective. And so that was actually, you know, I broke the rule by not doing anything, but I think it was the right rule to break.
Right. It's almost like in an organization where they don't have a certain staff that in your mind you rely on all the time for leadership. There's a certain tool you rely on all the time for leadership to really know what's going on in your system in terms of quality and safety and so forth, and felt like sort of like it was your remiss as a leader in not having it. So
right.
You broke that rule and started to use that right away.
Yep, but other than that, I was pretty true of just listening and not making any changes. But then once I got to that 100 days, I really made quite a bit of changes. We had been working through strategies as we were thinking about what to do. And so at that point, we were able to kind of say, hey, here's where our strategies are, and here's the team we're going to use to lead those strategies. And, you know, off we went.
Tim, talk about the current COVID situation. And as such, when do health systems and schools and all of us get back to a new normal, or is this it? Is this our new normal? Give us a few cents of where your sense things are at.
Yeah, I mean, I think this has obviously been devastating to the economy. It's been devastating to people's lives. People have lost their lives. This has been hard for health systems, and Integris is, you know, kind of in the mix of all those hard things going on. But we've handled it well. You know, we've treated the most COVID patients in Oklahoma, and our caregivers are doing a great job. They've obviously gotten a lot better at treating COVID and understanding what to do and not to do. Clearly, some therapies like remdesivir and convalescent plasma and proning the patient on high-flow oxygen as opposed to venting as much as you can have really helped. So we're seeing more people walk out of the hospital than at first because I think we're getting better at it. The COVID situation in Oklahoma is not like it is in Texas, thankfully, but we continue to move up in our numbers. Hospitalizations across the state are on the incline. They kind of went up quickly after we reopened, and they've kind of stayed there. But, I mean, we are busy. Our hospitals are near capacity every single day. And, you know, we were already at capacity before. Oklahoma is not as healthy as it ought to be. And so, our hospitals operated pretty full all the time. And so this has just created additional difficulties in, you know, getting staff and so forth to take care of the patients. So that's been challenging. Obviously, PPE early was really hard. It's still touch and go. We've had to pay a lot more money for our PPE, and we're still doing multi-use for many of the personal protective equipment devices, and that's you know, that's saving us from some of the shortages that are still out there. So that's been very challenging. Obviously, financially, it's been very difficult. The CARES money certainly helped. But, you know, as we look out into the subsequent years or subsequent months with COVID continuing, it's hard to see that there's going to be the same level of support that was there, which makes it challenging for organizations who already, you know, function on a thin margin. So, but, you know, we'll get through this. I mean, the way I look at COVID is it's just another one of the many things that we treat. And at some point, we're going to figure out some sort of therapy that's going to help people get more back to normal. But I think for right now, we just say, wear your masks, social distance, wash your hands, and carry on.
And you said something very interesting. More and more, it's another disease state versus just COVID. It's more and more, we treat cancer, we treat heart disease, we treat a million other things, and we're treating COVID versus it's all COVID all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, and, you know, in the initial phases of the shutdown, people were so scared of it, they were staying home having a heart attack or a stroke, and we kept saying, no, you need to come in, we can take care of you, you can still have a baby, it's safe to do that. And I think we've been able to get the community back to where they are understanding they can still get care. But you know, we have to treat COVID, and we have to treat strokes and everything else that comes in, and that's what our mission is, and that's what we're going to do. You know, I think the COVID numbers are always so tricky. When you look at the gross numbers, they're shocking. And then when you sort of peel the layers of the onion back, it's like, okay, there's a pattern here. For example, and these numbers bounce around, right? But for 70, 75% of the people that have COVID in the hospital, in Integris facilities, they have some, at least one underlying comorbidity. So if you're a person that has a comorbidity, some, you know, this is a disease you just want to be really careful to avoid and take extra precautions. So we've also seen the disparities of care. So we've seen high proportion of our patients being Hispanic. And we're not quite sure what's going on there, but we, you know, that's concerning for us. So we've got to be thinking about, well, how do we get in front of the Hispanic population and help them in a situation to be successful in not getting this disease. And I would say we're still early in trying to understand what's really going on there, but we have a hunch that it's probably some of these social determinants situations, you know, maybe living in multi-generational homes and so forth, that maybe make them more susceptible to COVID.
And spreads more easily and so forth because of the multi-generation homes. Where you've got that, you seem to have much greater spread.
Right.
And also just much harder to socially distance and all those things. And also harder to work remotely if
right.
people are working certain kinds of jobs. It's just harder to do so.
Right.
Another question for you. Tim, when you look at the next 6 months, your top three priorities right now?
Well, I think, first of all, it's keep our caregivers safe. So safety is our top priority. Save as many lives as possible. Take care of all the other health needs of the community and get to this being financially viable on the other end. And I think those are kind of the four things that we've said when we went in. You know, there's the pandemic imperatives. These are the four things we keep talking with our people about. And they're all not easy, right? Because if you just take care of all the COVID and you don't take care of the heart patients or the cancer patients or whatever else, then you're not serving the community. You have to do both, and you have to keep your people safe, and we have to come through financially viable on their side, and those are the things that we're really focused on.
I mean, it really does. You try and simplify it as much as possible, and so these are the four things, and it creates great clarity, but it is a complex maze to accomplish those four things.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's many things. And I'll tell you, it is tricky because you're so focused on COVID, and yet there's so many other things that you need to do as an organization to move the organization forward, and you can't put those on the shelf either. So it's really, you know, what we've been talking to our people about is, particularly our leaders, is we really have to learn to live with this, and it can't be all consuming. We have to be able to navigate COVID, and we have to be able to navigate moving people to value and improving safety and quality and all the things that we were undertaking before COVID hit the scene.
Right. And what you're saying is more and more the clarity of message you get from health system leaders that we've got to be doing COVID and not COVID or. It's got to be COVID.
Right.
And running a system. And what you said about the Cures Act is very true for health systems. It's very true for all kinds of Americans of every sort, that there's only so much stimulus funding that there can be. And so sooner or later, it's trying to make sure people and systems and companies are as much as possible viable on the other end of this, on the other side of it too.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
What Tim, it's a great pleasure getting a chance to visit with you today. Magnificent career.
Pleasure.
Magnificent job at Integris. Just fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Scott.